Welcome back to the second module of the day. This is the second day of the course. This is developing universal Windows apps with C# and XAML. I'm Jerry, this is Darren, and we going to talk about data.
Data and local data.
All right.
So, quick look at the module agenda. So the storage landscape, you know, have a quick talk about what's available to us. We're gonna talk about SQLite. We're gonna talk about settings, what they mean to us in a universal app. We're also going to talk about blob storage, what it is, how to use it. And then we're going to have a light discussion on provisioning strategies.
Got it.
So first of all, let's talk about the storage landscape. So here's one of the challenges that I think everybody felt when we first started working with Windows Store applications. And it was the lack of direct access to data storage, specifically system data, SQL CE, SQL Server. That there was no immediate means to actually access data. You had to leverage some third-party service, WCF services, REST services, OData services, and actually to get to some sort of persistent data store.
That was really frustrating, not just because it wasn't provided, but there was no alternative.
Yeah.
And so developers were scratching their head trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah, so a lot of us initially used custom serialization to files in our isolated storage.
Yep, I certainly did.
So what was included, as we mentioned, was a whole bunch of infrastructure that allowed you to leverage web-based resources. And as we mentioned yesterday, that's been enhanced with access now to the HTTP client that provides full asynchronous access out to these web services and so on. However, there was a big gaping void for some form of SQL-based local storage. Fortunately, there's a product out there called SQLite that is very, very popular in the open source community. And is written in C, so it's eminently portable to other platforms, and so a version was created for this.
Yep, a lot of Microsoft developers don't immediately recognize just how popular SQLite is.
Yes, absolutely. Some other areas that you could store data, one of them was OneDrive, and we actually explored that pretty substantially in the advanced Jumpstart.
That's right, yeah.
Where we kind of created a service layer that kind of sat on top of the APIs and leveraged that for storage using some convention-based sort of a taxonomy for storing information.
Certainly it had a requirement that the user had to have a Microsoft account, which is sometimes tricky when you're inside an enterprise. You may not have that.
Yep.
And there were also some, it was also a little brittle because the user at any time could go into their OneDrive and monkey with, I guess, the data that you had stored there.
Yeah, it'd also be great if somebody set the timer off for us, thank you. we could also use Windows Azure.
Who's running this
place? I know.
Oh my.
Yesterday they were on it, today they're just on something.
Good gravy.
So we talked about Windows Azure, we've talked about that quite a bit. You know, we have the SQL databases, so we demonstrated using those yesterday. There's table storage, which is an initial implementation of a NoSQL solution.
Yes, that's right.
And was basically there in the initial release of Azure.
It was the first.
Yeah, it was there before that. Nobody's going to use SQL in the cloud.
I'm glad they called it table storage so that nobody understood it.
Yeah, exactly. Table storage, what's that?
Sounds like SQL tables.
And now, of course, we have DocumentDB going on live.
That's true. That's in preview right now.
Exactly. And also blob storage, which really sits on top of table storage.
And we'll talk about that today because that's what we really use in Solarizer.
Yep. Sounds good. Well, let's move on. So let's talk about SQLite. So we kind of touched on it anyway, but SQLite is a popular open source cross-platform embedded database written in C. What does that mean to you as a universal app developer? Means you can install it into your universal apps, both in Windows Phone and on the Windows side.
That's right.
And you can leverage it using SQL, link-based queries.
SQL, the language,
yeah,
T-SQL.
Yeah, SQL. T-SQL is a variant. To actually interact with it locally and use it for your intermediate data store, which is kind of nice. And we used that in Solarizer to store our local state before we submit to the server.
It also means if you're the type of developer who may have an Android application or you may have an iOS application or really almost any platform, this is probably what you're already using or is also an option for you there. And it's going to be a familiar resource for you.
Yeah, the great thing as well is there's also NuGet packages that provide a layer on top of the baseline SQLite API calls that are just kind of rapid initially, to give you a more fluent interface that you may be more familiar with as a .NET developer.
Talking about Azizi, I think maybe we should show them SQLite. How about that?
Let's go for it. So we're going to use a Prism startup project. So here's one that we already have available to us.
We can only build view models so many times.
Yeah, I mean, you guys don't want to see us re-implement it. So here's a base project. You know, we can see, you know, no smoke and mirrors here. It runs in both platforms.
I like switching platforms like that. It's a nice.
It is nice. You know, so here we have the same app running in both. Great.
You pretty awesome UI you've designed.
I know. I mean, that is my best UI ever. So now, that's our startup. So let's go about getting hold of the SQLite extension for the Windows head.
Oh, you don't use NuGet.
I do not use NuGet. The reality is, because this is a native API, we need to install this as an extension rather than a NuGet package.
Okay.
And so this will end up in a different place in our add references dialog to be able to incorporate into our application. So you would just go here and download both of these and then install them.
Got it.
I happen to have them already installed.
Right.
So we didn't run through that particular
example. I'm glad you do, because you have to restart Visual Studio.
Exactly. It's a bit of a pain in the butt. So then you come in and you check this to add the references. Notice that there's a little yellow icon on there. I'll come back to that in a second.
And I notice when you're adding the reference, you go to extensions.
Exactly, because it's extending out the SDKs available. It's not part of NuGet, and it's not a regular assembly. So here we have these yellow icons. That's because this is a native assembly that it has an affinity to a specific processor, so won't run under any CPU. We have to specify the processor.
Oh, you didn't pick x64.
That's because I want to continue to have design time experience within my application development environment. x86 and any CPU allows me to use the design surface. x64 presently isn't supported as a design surface.
Now, I thought we couldn't get this off of NuGet.
So now I'm adding in the SQLite-net extension, which allows me to use a series of APIs to interact more fluently with SQLite itself.
You said extension, but I bet you meant SDK.
I meant SDK, and I meant a NuGet package. You're absolutely right. So those are added into both heads. I could just as easily drag those source files into shared.
You didn't need to add that, by the way. You could do it all by hand, but this just adds that link syntax so it's comfortable for .NET developers.
Exactly. So now let's look at adding a model. So what we're going to do is create a class that represents a user that we're going to store in our SQLite database.
Kind of like what a user we had for Galactic Attack?
Pretty similar, that has to be said.
All right. So SQLite that you're making a reference to is SQLite-net.
Correct. So this gives us access to those APIs, and we're going to use that in a moment. So pretty much straightforward, regular .NET properties I'm creating here. So we're going to have an ID, we're going to have a username, which is going to be a string. We'll add in a high score, which will be an integer. No need to get too fancy with a high score, after all.
Right. Can you imagine a float?
Yeah. Score? Oh, I beat you by 0.001. You're crushed. So now we're going to mark up some attributes, and these attributes are going to come in from SQLite, and then we're going to turn around and say that this is the primary key for our table. We're also going to specify that it's auto-increment, which allows SQLite to inject into here the values for the ID upon insertion.
So you're saying this is a column, and you're saying when you create this column, use this column, it's called ID.
Correct.
I get it.
So we could actually differentiate between the column names and the property values if we wanted to. I actually believe in keeping them the same. I think it makes it much easier to read, but you may have a good reason why you don't want to. You may inherit a legacy schema. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a schema that you've leveraged in another platform, and you happen to want to reuse the name from a business process perspective.
Right.
This allows
you
to map those to that.
You know, some dork DBA made it unreadable.
Yeah, decided they wanted to use three characters. So we've created our model. So now we're going to integrate this into our view model. The approach I'm going to take inside the view model is a little bit non-standard in terms of we're not really talking about a true application lifecycle here. So I'm going to do a lot of the initialization of SQLite and setting up the tables in line, basically on the onNavigated2 method within this. But essentially, this is really going to tell you the story of how we're going to do it. So let's create the override for our... Oh, initially I need to hang on to my connection, actually. So we're going to create a SQLite async connection. because we're on the Windows Store, we need to be running inside the with asynchronous methods. And here I'm specifying the file for my database that's going to be stored in my local storage.
.db, is that a requirement as an extension?
No, nope, it's just a name.
Okay, got it. Got it. Does it translate to a file?
This is a flat file that will be stored in my local storage, yes.
Okay. So we're overriding on navigated to, I'll let you keep typing.
That sounds like a good plan. But thank you, it allows me to type.
I can't hear the type.
These quiet keyboards are incredible, Barry. Thank you.
So basically we're going to be creating a table. We're going to add data to the table. Then we're going to basically retrieve all records from that table. And then finally, we're going to do a very simple query to retrieve a single record by its ID. So that's basically the demo we're going to put together here. And it's amazingly simple and straightforward to do so.
If anybody's wondering why it's kind of grayed out, you have ReSharper installed.
I'm using ReSharper. And so ReSharper is telling me that this is a meaningless method right now because all I do is override and then call base. As soon as I add other capability into the method, it goes, okay, now this is no longer useless and stops it being grayed out.
So connection.createTableAsync
just turns around and looks at the model and creates a table called user.
What if the table's already there?
If the table's already there and it's identical, it does not destroy it, doesn't damage any data. If it is there and there are new columns in your user object, it will create them. It will not update and replace or delete columns that are missing from the user table if you create them.
And if I change the data type and not the name,
it will not do a migration for you.
I see. Very good. What if the database hasn't been created? All of that's included in the create table async?
Exactly.
Got it. So now we're just going to insert those same classes you just created.
Yeah, so I'm creating instances.
Put my name here.
Notice that I'm not putting in an ID because we're using auto increment. So if I put semicolon on here, then that's basically our insert. And as you can see, it's inserting an enumerable. So it'll go through each of those records. To get the data is actually incredibly simple.
Especially if you know link.
Especially if you know link. But you actually don't even need to know link for this particular query because we just do get table. And then we specify that we want to get the contents as a list asynchronously. And that's just going to take it and project into user the all of the users that are in that table.
Could I put a dot where on that and kind of filter it out?
This would be the very next statement.
Oh my gosh. What if you wanted just one?
This would be it. Await connection.table. So once again, we're getting our table object. Then we're going to specify a where clause. And we're going to do a predicate that specifies the membership of the set that we're looking for.
Is it important to put the where to the left of the to list async?
Depends on how you want to realize your data set. If you have it to the left, then it gets created as part of the SQL that we're sending across the wire. If you put it to the right of the to list, then you're actually realizing a list in memory locally.
Yeah.
You're running all of that in SQLite, and then you're converting it and filtering that in memory list.
Yeah.
So it really does change.
I think I'm distracting you, sorry. But I just want to reiterate what you just said. You could, if you have a gigantic table, you bring it into memory if you put the where to the right of the list.
Yeah. So definitely, list should be the last thing you're doing unless you're specifically intending to bring this. So here we should be able to check and see that our users have been pulled across into this field. So if we look, we've got a count of two. Drill in. Here's our model with our user values.
We're tied right now at 1,000 points.
Yep. If we step over, we can see now we can really focus in on Jerry. And we can see this has successfully retrieved it based upon the ID.
Oh, you didn't even set the ID. The auto increment worked.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's as simple and straightforward as that. Now, obviously, there's more things you can do in terms of putting queries and so on and so forth together.
What if you had a second table? Could I join them together as I query?
So although the idea does exist within SQLite to have foreign keys and so on, the current state of the libraries that we're using does not support foreign keys and these automatic joins and so on. There's absolutely the way to write SQL that does those queries and does those joins and so on and so forth. To be honest, it's a pretty simple API right now, but it really satisfies most of the use cases you're going to have for locally stored data. If you're going to be storing huge amounts of data, you perhaps want to think about, well, maybe this should in fact be out on a server, and I shouldn't be bringing all of that stuff over.
We use this in Solarizer to basically the data that you're, the small subset of data just for that user, the appointments they're going to, that's what we store locally just in case they get disconnected.
Yeah.
And then that way they still have a good experience.
They can still do their updates, they can still capture the notes, take photos and incorporate it in a completely disconnected environment.
We don't put the photos into the database though, right? Because the file system is fully sufficient to do that for us.
Exactly. You know, on our local system, what we do is you bring up the picture picker.
Yep.
And you choose one of those. We copy it from its location in your pictures gallery into local storage, actually within the application space. And then we use that as the path for our images we display in the application. And we write that path into the table in SQLite.
So there's a link from the database to it, but we don't actually bload it up with
exactly. Then when we choose to upload the appointments once we've committed and submitted the changes, then we transfer the photos to Blob Storage in Azure, which we'll talk about in a little while. And we take the path that the Blob Storage provides and we put that into our database that we're storing up in the cloud.
Yeah, it's a pretty slick implementation, to be honest.
And it's how you would implement these things in the real world.
One thing to think about when developers use local databases is that incremental IDs can actually cause quite a problem.
They absolutely can. So one of the what we did to address that is we use GUIDs, or globally unique identifiers.
Yep.
So whenever you're using something where you know you're going to be merging together, say for example, if Jerry and I both have a local instance of the app, the first time we insert a record into a table, we're both going to use user ID 1.
You know, that is now we are in conflict.
If we try and upload them, first in wins.
Yeah, that's right. I'll overwrite yours, you'll overwrite mine, one or the other.
So the only real guaranteed technique to avoid that is to use generated keys, use GUIDs, and insert them as strings or as unique identities.
Right. And for those of you who aren't from Australia, he means GUID is what he means. That's what you meant.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Tomato, tomato.
Tomato, tomato. Oh, somehow I went back in time here. Hang on just a second. All right. So that's a local database. Now let's talk about settings. Settings is something that's built in. This is the application data namespace. So the application data namespace is built into the Windows runtime. That's what we're going to be using. This is stuff that you would have. The idea of preferences for a user when they're changing color, size, something like that. Maybe whether or not they want, in Solarizer, for example, we have whether or not you want to use sample data or not because we demo this, right?
Yep.
And but maybe you go in for other purposes as well. You can see the settings charm and that flyout that comes out from it, then list settings over on the right, settings about privacy and permission come for free.
Not privacy.
Just permission comes for free. We added the top three, and each of those is implemented specifically for Windows because that's the way the settings flyout operates. When you do it for phone, it's a dedicated page, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to use it, by the way, in the charms. It used to be that you felt like if you're going to use settings, use the settings charm. The discoverability of that is just not as good as it could have been. So now we're like, you can put that straight on your application if you need to because we want your users to be able to find your settings.
Yeah, in fact, those people who've looked at Windows 10 since it's been out, they will assume that the charms have moved.
That's right. That's right. Or at least will soon. No, the adjust. So let's some strategies around settings. The first is that you would adjust them occasionally. We don't want to make your application so burdensome that the user is constantly going into this flyout and adjusting things on and off. If you have things that need to be inside the constant workflow of the application, you might put that actually in the app bar and let them manipulate it there. It also, you want to depend on user preferences. You want to make it so that the user makes a change and that you you honor those.
Mm-hmm.
But even more so, you want them to be able to make it so that they launch their application and don't have to change anything for the most part. Right? You want to make it as configurable as possible, perhaps. But you definitely want to default it to the way you think most users are going to be able to use your app so they don't have to do a whole bunch of stuff before they get started. The other thing is there's not going to be a save button. This is a typical implementation now for almost every universal app that as soon as you make a change, you immediately save those changes back into settings. That's a little bit different than the way we would In Solarizer, we're editing a record, and then there is a save button. That's because the edits you make might actually cascade or have something to do with other fields. If that's the use case, yeah, you'd have a save button. But settings usually are atomic, a one-off sort of thing.
Yeah, we also, because we have the state management and so on and so forth, as you're partway through editing, if for whatever reason you leave that application experience, those changes that you're partway through are persisted.
Right. In order to add that, whenever the flyout occurs, an event is raised by the system, you handle that event, you add commands to it. This is greatly simplified by Prism MVVM. And so remember, we replaced the application base with MVVM app base. And this gives us an extension point called get settings commands. This is only, again, for Windows. And basically, whenever that event is raised, you just override it. When it is raised, you set up what the command is going to be as a settings command. And then at the very last line, you can see you return all of those. They get appended then for you, and everything in the Prism infrastructure handles the rest for you. Now, in this case, I'll just point out, and we'll talk about this a little bit later today, we're setting the settings label as settings, the about label as about, and the privacy label as privacy. That's okay if you think that all your users are going to speak English. Mm-hmm. But the reality is you might be pulling this from a resource to make sure that this applies and is dynamically affected by whatever locale the user has in their settings.
Yep.
Has nothing to do with your application, by the way. That's a Windows setting. And we'll talk about that more. This is the settings flyout control itself. It's really great that we have a settings flyout control that's new in Windows 8.1 when they added that. We had all had to write our own, and it was a pain in the neck to get right. And so they did it, and this gets it right. And honestly, it's one of the easiest things to implement. One of the things to make it look just right so that your settings dialog looks good, they've included a bunch of resources that kind of ship with Windows now. And so you can see we could use the, in fact, it's right here, the settings flyout section style. The settings flyout section style allows us to make all the app, and it also influences the font size and things like that as well. The nice thing is, as soon as I create a settings flyout from scratch, all of those styles are injected real quickly, and I can see the lorem ipsum version of it, and I can just monkey with those.
Absolutely.
Pretty great. Persisting settings. So there is the application data namespace, and the application data namespace allows me to interact with the settings API. However, we've wrapped that up into the storage helper, and the storage helper is just a C# class that if you look at it, you can see how it's all implemented. It's just a class, just a mm-hmm. bunch of code. It's not too bad, but it ultra simplifies it. And so now you can see I've created a use sample data only Boolean property, and all I have to say is return storage helper get setting. And in there is a lot of checking because as soon as you ask for a setting, it may not be there. As soon as you ask for a setting, it doesn't come back typed, so you have to cast it. And when you try to cast it, it may not work. So there's a lot of boilerplate code that you need. What you're really wanting to say is, go get it if it's there. And if it's not, you can see a comma true at the end of that line. Here's the default if it's not found. So in this case, use sample data will be true until the user changes it. And as soon as they do, the first one will be injected. Again, we're using storage helper.setSetting, and we pass in whatever that setting is. In this case, it's just a dictionary.
Yep.
And so that string represents the dictionary name.
And as we can see from the implementation here, if you're bound to this user sample only property, the set will immediately write that setting back into memory, thus satisfying our need that we don't need a save button to turn around and commit these things.
Yep, that's exactly right. What I would probably do if I were writing this for my view model is I would raise property changed right after that setter, right? This doesn't do it for you. Great. Let's look at the storage helper just as a code review. And we're going to do a lot of code review today. So mm-hmm. I think this will be great. The storage helper is inside Solarizer. I've used it on hundreds of projects. I put it up on my website a long time ago. And developers use it constantly. I get emails about it. And we've tweaked the out of it. It's really great now. All right, so we put it in shared, which is where we have a lot of our reusable code. This API is 100% the same on Windows or Windows Phone. And so let me go into Storage Helper. It's right here inside the common folder. And so if we look at it, I'm going to collapse it because the implementation itself really doesn't matter. What's great, though, having a helper like this is you see the full implementation. And where sometimes you and I will create a view service, and we just create one or two methods, whatever we need mm-hmm. right away. We don't create everything. Storage Helper implements I would say 90% of all the things that are created that are available. So here's the settings part of it. It also handles file read and write and file serialization. Certainly helps around that. So if you need to save a file, you can pass a class to it. It serializes it and saves it up into your local storage. It's really nice. And then you can, of course, read it, deserialize it, and it does all that for you as well. And so a lot of power there.
And of course, that was how we had to deal with local storage, you know, writing and serializing files when we didn't have a local database that we could use.
100%. That is the legacy of why this was written in the first place. It was a real pain not having a database. So I wrote this helper to kind of solve the problem. That's exactly right. And so here's the settings information by itself. So there's only a couple things you need to do. The first one is whether or not it exists. This is pretty handy sometimes. If you, I actually don't find I use it very often, but it is what it is. It returns whether or not it's there or not. You'll also notice that none of the setting interaction is asynchronous. That's because settings aren't asynchronous. You really, in the end, are just reading and writing from a dictionary, so it's pretty quick, and there's no async operation behind the scenes.
One use for the settings exists is to determine whether this application has been launched for the first time. Is you can check to see whether you've actually created something and so on.
That's a great point. Yep, that is absolutely a great point. Then the get setting is a generic method where you're indicating the type of the setting that's coming back. This will influence the cast, and it will make sure that you get the data type that you expect. Remember, we pass in the key as just a string, but then that same data type is going to be what you pass in as the otherwise, or otherwise is what that default is going to be. I had to name it otherwise because default is a reserved word in C#.
Yeah, you can't default.
Yeah, exactly. Set setting exactly what you think as well. This pushes it into the dictionary for you. But there's a couple caveats that are worth saying here. A couple of things can't be properly serialized. It's really a bummer. One of them is time span. Time span is might be something you really want serialized. One of the first apps I put together was a timer. I have the free timer in the store. It's kind of fun. But that application really drove me crazy because I wanted to put in the settings where the timer started so that if the user ever suspended the application and came back, I could resume it. But I couldn't do that. So what I ended up doing was writing a little wrapper around time span that would, when I save the setting, it would just turn into a string, right? Mm-hmm. And save that as a string.
Convert it to a string, date time format in a string, and then
that's right.
Reverse it, yeah.
And so, I mean, there's no other way to do it. And so that's what I would actually put into settings and pull out. You as a developer might run into the same thing. You have something you want to put into settings and can't. You can just parse it, just turn it into a string and then parse it back out when you do it. It's not quite as clean. It's a bummer that's the way it works. And honestly, when you add settings, this storage helper to your project, you could just embed that logic here and you wouldn't even know what was going on. Delete settings just removes it so it's not there. Of course, settings exist would return false after that. For the sake of discussion though, since we're talking about the file does a lot of things that are really great. And so this is all the file interactions inside Storage Helper. The first one is file exists, it turns out. File exists is not a built-in method inside the API. So if you want to see if a file exists, one of the things you can do is go into the folder, get a list of everything, and see if your file is there by name. That's a pretty expensive one. Another way you can do it is try and access it and wait for the exception to be raised. Either way you want to do it, it's wrapped up right here so that you can ask if it's there. It's an asynchronous operation. Almost all the file operations are asynchronous because the all of the storage file APIs are asynchronous too, right? So a file exists, and then you can do it different ways, whether or not you want to see where it's located. So in this case, there's an override. The first one is the location, where you're using different storage strategies. And remember, we have four storage strategies inside Windows Runtime. The first one is local, then we have running. We also have a temp folder dedicated to our application. And now we have a new cache folder. It's basically where we put things, but it's not backed up by the operating system automatically. And so that kind of saves when we're pushing things up in the cloud whenever we're roaming from app to app or from device to device. And so another one, there's an override right here where you can pass in a specific folder. And remember, this may or may not work. And the reason I say that is if your application doesn't have access permissions from the AppX manifest, you're not going to have access to certain folders. So you're going to need that capability first in your application, but then now you've got the method to do it. Delete file does exactly what you think. It'll find the file based on its name and then look in a location. I can read a file the same way. I can write a file the same way. What's different between this read and write and the one that's built into the file I/O namespace that's inside the runtime is that this is really intended for serializing your class and then deserializing your class as it comes back out. You might need to think this through. Some things, again, aren't serializable, aren't deserializable. If that's not working, you're going to have to register your type with a serializer and do it in a different way. I would say for about 75% of all the classes being written and read, this is all automatic right out of the gate. This doesn't use Newtonsoft's JSON.NET. I was trying to write this so it didn't have a dependency on anything. You could just copy the class and drop it in. If that was what you really wanted to do, is use that JSON.NET, it's not a big deal to swap those things out as well. Anyway, so I can create files, read files, check if they exist, all the stuff that's actually a little bit of a challenge, all wrapped up into the storage helper. We put that inside Solarizer. We'll put that code up on xaml.codeplex.net. XAML.codeplex.com in a few days. Anyway, that's the storage helper. And so that's writing data that's local. But we also have this idea of blob storage as well. So blob storage is specific to Azure. Obviously, it's not specific to Azure. But we are specific to Azure in the way that we implemented it. There are other blob storage providers out there, like AWS, no doubt about it, and AT&T. If you look at the Gartner MQ, AT&T is the third leader for storage on the internet. Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. For cloud storage. I totally didn't expect to see them there. But it's totally true. They do a lot. None of that matters. All right. So let's talk about blob storage inside Azure. Right now, they report to us they have 10 trillion objects in Azure storage. This would include table and other things too, but 10 trillion, Darren. I tried counting up to 10 trillion. It took too long, but that is a huge, huge number.
It is a big number.
And as far as transactions, it's very, very fast. The 4 trillion objects requested per month, right? That's pretty serious. It doesn't say how many of those are successful. Just kidding. Yes. All right. So let's talk about what blobs are. There are really two types. First of all, the blob itself is just a file. Whatever it is you want it to be.
What does blob stand for?
Thing. Binary large object. What's the S for? Plural. So anyway, what could that be for you? It could be an image. That's what it is for us in Solarizer. It also could be a document that you're uploading or an etc. That's another option. Mm-hmm. Honestly, you could put anything. I could see easily putting, not necessarily videos. I might put a video up there and then run it, and then route it through the media service for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you can sit a content distribution network on top of this to actually speed access to things that are predominantly static. So,
that's right. And you can make it redundant not only locally inside the data center that you have it, but you can also set it up to be redundant geolocation-wise so that you can make sure that it's here and in a data center that's in a different location. That can speed things up, but it can also give you a little peace of mind as far as security. That's pretty cool by itself. A blob itself is limited to 200 gigabytes. There's two types of blobs. There's also a page type.
But let's just think about that. The blob is limited to 200 gigabytes.
200 gigabytes, not 200 gigawatts.
Yes. So in many cases, you know, not only are people using it for images and so on and so forth, it's something we were going to touch on in a little while, you can also store backups there.
Yeah. 200 gigabytes goes a long way quickly.
Yeah. But don't expect to download it fast.
Or upload it fast.
Yes.
It's not that Azure's slow.
No.
My upload speeds are not going to allow that to happen.
Yeah, don't do 200 gigabytes on your phone.
Okay, hang on just a second. I'm saving this. Oh, my gosh. That'd be an incredible phone, though, to have that much storage.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
As soon as I put up...
That would be an incredible phone bill, too.
Hopefully your grandfather had unlimited data. Although they would ratchet you down, you'd probably get a call from somebody. I wonder who. All right, so there's also page-type blobs. Page-type blobs have a limit of 1 terabyte. A 1 terabyte would allow me to put something like a VHD up there, and that's the reason it's page-type. It allows me to read portions of it at once rather than just get the whole thing and then use it. That would be a terrible experience for an attachable hard drive. So that's the way VHDs work for the VMs inside Azure anyway, and so it's really great. Anyway, so those are your two options. Surely the easiest one is going to be the 200 gigabyte standards blob.
Yep.
And what's great is once I have that up there, I can access it via a URL. That can be a private URL to make sure nobody has access except for the people you want to, or it can be totally public. You can put all kinds of resources that you want, all of your documents, PDFs, training materials, whatever that is, put it all up there, share that link, and you can kind of count on anybody can get it and pull that down as if it was on your web server, mm-hmm. but it's actually being served up from this blob service.
Which is precisely why we can use it to store images and then reference that path in our image source.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so here's an example of what that URL would look like. It would be HTTP, whatever that storage account you would create, right? Like Galactic Attack or whatever, .blob.core.windows.net/ and then it goes to container. And so the container is sort of like a folder. You have to have a container to put your blob into. Your account, your subscription can have an unlimited number of containers that you need. And then inside a container, you put the blob, and your container can have an unlimited number of blob. I would like to challenge that and see if what unlimited really means. Infinite's an awfully
big
number. Well,
once you get up to 10 trillion, you can then turn around.
10 trillion in one, crash the entire internet.
Exactly. So one of the other uses for containers is gives you a level of granularity around accessing information and also can be used as a unit of geolocation specificity.
I can set security on a blob, but I can set it higher just on the whole container.
Yep.
Yeah, that's right. I can also use that for maybe tenant as well, you know, make sure that data is separate. And of course, tenant data is important not just for if you have multiple customers, but it might be important internally where you need to separate your data for some sort of perhaps even a legal reason.
Right? Yep.
Let's see. Windows Azure Storage. That's the name of the SDK that Azure provides to us to interact with.
Recently enhanced to fully support Universal.
Recently enhanced. And by recently, we mean very recent.
Yes, indeed.
And, but I've tested it. It works. It's beautiful.
Yep.
Absolutely beautiful. It's worth pointing out, and we've got this on the right of the slide here, that we have created two things. A blob helper. So the blob helper allows us to allows us to wrap all this together. So the blob helper isn't meant just for our application. This is sort of the all-together interaction with Windows Azure Storage SDK, and sort of like the storage helper, just to make life easier. But then we also created a blob service. That's for the specific implementation inside our Solarizer application. Pretty great. Now there is this idea of provisioning, and this is something that we were excited to do in inside Solarizer. And the idea is this: I get an application that I install now, and it's a little bit stale, right? It's been inside the store or where, however it is I install it, for let's say a month. But in that month, the team recognizes that several of the drop-down boxes, several of the basic information that needs to be inside the app is actually out of date. We need to add a few things. Mm-hmm. And so now it's, I ran the application. How do I provision down a fresh database or so that fresh information that allows me to have a full experience that's up to date? So the idea would be I would have a SQLite database.
Yeah, so you know, if we kind of run through the application startup, initially the idea would be that we would kind of run through what I talked about initially with SQLite. You go through, you connect, create your connection. By creating a connection, it looks to see if the database file exists. If the database file exists, it's going to, or doesn't exist, it's going to create it. You're going to create your tables, and that's going to be fine for the schemas that you have in place. So as you say, it starts up and it's stale. It's couple of versions out of date,
and you would know it was out of date because hopefully you would have some sort of version indicator on the local database that you could
maybe
ask
you
the
write
server.
Into your settings. You know, you turn around and say, "Yeah, my initial setting was V1."
Yeah,
and then you
the server is returning V1.1.
Yeah, and you turn around and say, "Oh, I need to upgrade." So then you could conceivably pull down something different, and so the idea is that you may have a default schema for your SQLite database stored as a blob up in the cloud that you could then pull down a version and write to your local storer, and from that point forward, connect to that SQLite database and pull in your reference data. That's certainly one way that we could
certainly think it through. Don't overwrite local data if the user's editing it. But this is a provisioning experience of when I first load up, if it's out of date, just pull it down and all my dropdowns are fresh.
So another way to do it would be to actually abstract away the creation of these into some form of script.
Yeah.
and actually pull down from there a script that gets run locally. Now, the advantage of using the script-based approach is it deals with the scenario where you actually have an existing database with data, as Jerry's pointed out, and we're actually modifying the schema. Maybe we are going through the scenario where we need to change the type of a column. Maybe we had some sort of constraint on there that we need to relax, or we need to impose a constraint that we missed. You know, we need to put a not null on a column or whatever it's going to be, and we already have null data. So we have to pre-run some sort of data prep that inserts default values in before we try and enforce the constraint. So this gives us the opportunity to update our data store without having to reissue and recertify an application, which is kind of a key scenario.
Now, the migration process of coming, you know, I just got 1.1.1, I have 1.0, a couple little pieces of data need to be handed over. There's that logic doesn't necessarily have to be in the client. I could easily have it so that my local database recognizes that it's out of date and uploads itself, lets the migration be taken care of by whatever facility we have in the cloud, and then I download my updated database as well. So don't feel like, look, I'm running this on a phone. In order to do all this ETL, I have to write all, no, you really don't. You can totally have it so that you send it back up and let the server take care of it, and you provision a tailored database back down to the device if that's necessary. So don't feel like it's all or nothing. But that also leads into the idea of, I can take the database that I have local, and if I had this and I wanted to back it up to the cloud, I would copy it first, make sure there are no locks or anything like that. And I would have that copy then queued up so that it has a background upload to wherever my blob service is. So it gets uploaded. And the reason I use a background queue is I would think that my app would have the opportunity to be suspended. That could be a large upload, might even need to wait for Wi-Fi. I don't want to lose that opportunity. So even if they take a call or whatever it is, I know that it'll happen eventually.
Yeah, and we can use our sort of intermediate, you know, setting storage to indicate that we're actually in that cycle, so don't start up the application and complete the startup cycle until that is completed.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Perfect. All right, so that's the idea of provisioning and backup, basically, giving a good first experience and this migration to new schemas as they come along. Maybe you want to do it all on board. Maybe you want to offload it to the cloud.
Well, I mean, that is key in terms of mentioning the backup and so on. That certainly as the enterprise more fully embraces these types of applications, you know, there's obviously going to be a corporate concern about what happens if I drop my phone in my cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. You know, all the data that I've collated, maybe I haven't yet uploaded, or maybe there's just local information that's not being synchronized. And I would argue that your strategy should be to synchronize your data whenever you can, detect connectivity, and so on and so forth. But imagine the scenario.
But what you just meant was tiny little updates. Do this gigantic where you could lose the entire book.
Exactly. But if you were in the scenario where you wanted to take a complete snapshot of the current state. Say, for example, you were going to upgrade your device and you wanted to move to a new version of the device and you wanted to be able to pull down in one lump that configuration, then you could certainly envisage creating a facility that allows you to take that entire database, push up into storage in the cloud, get your new device provisioned, log in with your Active Directory credentials. It goes through the cycle of saying, hey, do I have a cached image up in the cloud? Yes, I do. Okay, pull that down. Then you've got an application, a full-blown application that has all your data already provisioned.
That's really beautiful. And it feels like I never lost my original phone, right? Mm-hmm. But the next phone almost picks up where I left off. That's
okay.
Nice. Very nice. All right, well, let's take a second to talk about something that seems to me to be totally...
totally randomly inserted at a certain point in the deck, and we might as well talk about it since this is there.
This is just one... This is a developer tip.
Yes.
That we wanted to share... but we couldn't find a really great place to put it.
Well, to be honest, I don't think we searched very hard, did we?
Let's remember to bring this up. Okay,
click.
We'll talk about it when we're talking about databases.
And here it is.
Anyway, here we go. When changing the phone command bar, the reality is we use a pivot in Solarizer.
Let me run that up.
Yeah, you know, because it's really pretty the way it happens as well.
Let me run that up.
But where we're headed with this is a custom experience for the user as they move from pivot to pivot. This is only on the phone that we're talking about. And just to kind of a little piece of design
course, my app
advice,
is set,
if nothing like that.
My app is set to pull down from the cloud, so it's sitting there for a little while.
Okay, no problem.
But let's drill into an appointment. So if I drill into this appointment here, what we have by default is we have a command bar, we have the phone. By the way, if we click on this, it actually pops up the UI to dial out.
That is brilliant.
It's pretty slick.
Including the address.
Yeah. So,
why am I acting so surprised?
I know, because you haven't seen it.
That's true.
You only code on the phone.
Right.
So we have these default actions, and we have the ability to do directions. And again, we demonstrated on the store that clicking on this would actually prompt the UI to download a map. The same experience happens in the phone, but because we're constrained to run on the emulator here, we actually can't install apps on the emulator,
right,
which is disappointing. So anyway, we have these default buttons. As I move across, you see how those pop down and new buttons pop in.
That's a really nice animation.
Not only does the animation bring in the new buttons, but it also draws your eye and lets you know that those commands have changed. Now, if we look down, a good convention is not to change these extended commands because you have no way of knowing that those have changed or not. As we move across.
Secondary commands, right?
Yep. Again, we see these different context-based commands.
The buttons in the command bar keep changing depending on which pivot you're in.
Exactly. And so what we're doing is we're detecting.
Is that difficult to code?
It's not difficult at all. And let's just show it. Why not? So we're in the appointment detail. So let's, that will be in the phone head. So in phone, views.
Oh, code behind, huh?
Appointment page, you got it. So this is one of those scenarios when we were talking about how you don't need to be a slavish adherent to the convention that says all your code needs to be in your view model. This is something that is specific to the view.
Yes.
And so there is no need to turn around and say, oh, how do I create all of the various commands?
Right.
And create all this binding backwards and forwards.
Don't exhaust yourself.
Yeah, so if we look at the setup of the app bar, we got a command bar here. This is our secondary commands. These are our pin menus. Let's move that away so we can actually see things a little bit. So here are our secondary commands. These are the pin and unpin. What a great design experience that is to just know and pop those things up, hey?
Honestly, it is.
And then here are all the app bars. So you can see a large number of app bars.
App bar buttons.
App bar buttons, you're absolutely correct. Notice I even when I copied this stuff across, I brought in the app bar separators. These are just null operations effectively on the phone. They make no impact whatsoever. Mm-hmm. We could just drag this whole thing across from the Windows head into here. And the great thing about these shared controls, because command bar is shared, is that it knows to render these up differently. It knows that there's only a maximum of four primary commands that can be shown. It knows the secondary commands aren't stuck on the left-hand side of the command bar as they are on the Windows platform. They're actually added as text-based commands here. Notice the icons are hidden and so on and so forth. It's great. But anyway, I've dropped all of these in here. And then if I look.
Each of them has an X name, I'll point out, which is an unusual thing in a MVVM application. Seems like you don't have an X name on controls usually.
Exactly, and that's because I want to be able to reference them directly in the code behind. So I should point out, I guess, that in here, I also have attached into the. Where is it? Oh, it's on the pivot. So on the pivot selection changed, so this event gets raised when I change the active pivot.
Because you want to change the buttons every time they switch from one pivot item to another. Got it.
You've got it, you're ahead of me. So on the pivot selection changed event, I basically pull in the selected index from my pivot, and I have a simple switch statement that says, based upon which pivot is being displayed, these are the buttons I want visible, these are the buttons I want to hide. And by setting everything to visible or collapse, as I move between these, I will get the animation.
Oh, so you don't just, what if you have one button that's the same from one pivot item to the other? Could you leave it alone?
You could leave it alone and it's not gonna break it, but what happens is the button does not animate. And so it looks kind of jarring. Maybe I should demonstrate.
So doing this setting of, no, that's okay, we get it. So doing this visibility switch causes the animation to occur. And by switching all of them, the animation occurs every single time. And what's nice about that is you get a fluid animation of all your buttons every time you change from one pivot item to another. The recommendation we're making is don't skip just one, because if you were to do that, then it would have one that looks weird, one that looks right. So just update all of them as you go from pivot to pivot. Is that right?
That's exactly it.
Did you just update the storage helper?
Apparently, whilst whilst you were talking about it, I managed to delete something. So,
go ahead and check that in. Just kidding. So you're going to show us kind of how it looks goofy if you do it wrong.
So this is the phone, and as I switch, see the phone just pops to the left rather than entering. And so the other ones bounce in, but that just kind of sticks around. And from a user experience perspective, it just looks jarring.
Yeah, it's just a matter of what's ugly.
Yep.
And a recommendation, you can make it all look really cool by setting all of them at one time. All right, that's our developer tip. A little bit out of sorts with storage, but at least we did. You were in Storage Helper for a second.
We were in Storage Helper. How close was that?
All right. Let's look back at the module and what we talked about. We've talked first about just the storage landscape, what your options aren't and what your options are. And so obviously we talked about SQLite as the number one relational storage in your universal application, fully supported, all the .NET candy that you want, and quite easy to implement, as Darren showed us. We walked through settings and how the Storage Helper makes that easy, but also how there are some strategies around settings to make it a better experience for your user. And then we talked about blob storage, specifically inside Azure, uploading something, some sort of file, getting that off the phone, getting that off the tablet, and putting it up where it can be shared in the cloud. You can make that public or you can make it private. And then we just talked about provisioning strategies, this idea of how you can take a database that is in the cloud, bring that down so the startup experience for the first installation is really great. Or you can make it so that the migration experience is really great for the user so that you can upload the database and pull down one ready and customize for them as well. And then we had this awesome developer tip, this idea of how to make your phone look a little bit better. Why not?
Right? Why not?
It's pretty cool.
Rude not to.
That's it for the module. This is the end of module 2. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and we're going to circle back around and
talk about communications.
Talk about communication in the next module. Go get yourself a soda. We'll talk to you in 10 minutes.